Okay, here we go. Right, the last of the classes in the Gothic novel section is on Mary Shelley and her fabulous work, Frankenstein. Has anybody read it? No? Really? Have you read it? No, okay. I'm hoping that I can inspire you to read it, even if not this year, next year, why not? It is absolutely fabulous. It really is. It's a very, very interesting piece of work. And it's very different from the other Gothic novels that we've seen. So, now, of course, Shelley herself is a fascinating character. So let's do a little bit of background, biographical details, because in this case, it's very important, I think, to understand. Oh, hang on a minute. What's the name? Did you do it? Okay. Well, it's okay. Right, let's have a look. So she was called, the author of Frankenstein was called Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley. She was born in 1797 and she died in 1851. So she was born at the end of the 18th century and she died in the middle of the Victorian period. She was the daughter of two celebrities at the time. She was the daughter of William Godwin, who was a political philosopher. He wrote political tracts. He also, interesting for us, he wrote the first mystery novel, Caleb Williams, which was a type of Gothic novel, but it had philosophical ideas, political ideas interwoven into it. Not much read nowadays, but obviously very, very influential on Mary herself. And her mother was one of the first feminist writers. She was called Mary Wollstonecraft, and she was a celebrated feminist writer of The Vindication of the Rights of Men, published in 1790, which attacked the monarchy and supported republicanism after the French Revolution. So French Revolution, 1789-99. So that was going on in the background of Mary's childhood, just as she was, when she was young. The reverberations of the French Revolution were very important at this time. And Wollstonecraft also wrote, more importantly, The Vindication of the Rights of Woman, 1792, one of the earliest pieces of feminist philosophy. And we know that, that Mary would have read this. But we also know that her mother died after giving birth to her, 12 days after giving birth to her, she died. And Mary was brought up with two stepsisters. One of the stepsisters was from a previous affair that her mother had had, and her father had adopted the daughter. The other sister, who was born with the woman that Godwin then married later on to be the mother, it was an incredibly bohemian background that Shelley comes out of. Thinkers, free thinkers, people who believed in free love, were politically very radical. She was brought up in a family who was not afraid to say things that were new. And then, on top of all this, in 1814, Mary Godwin met Percy Bysshe Shelley, the poet, who was interested in the political ideas of her father. So Shelley was, a follower of Godwin's politics, and Mary met him when she had been away in Scotland, and when she came back and she met Shelley. So it was love at first sight. And they eloped to Europe. What does to elope mean? They eloped to Europe. Oh, sorry. No, it's not escape, exactly. Elope always is related with running away to get married. To run away and get married when there is no parental consent, or perhaps somebody else is married to somebody else, as was the case with Shelley. Shelley was already married to somebody else called Harriet. Okay, but they were able to get married later on after Shelley's wife committed suicide. This is, I mean, it's a tremendously dramatic. The whole, group around Mary Shelley is full of dramatic deaths and suicides. Her half-sister by her mother with the previous affair actually committed suicide in my city, in Wales. I didn't know that until recently. Okay, so what else happened? Well, they ran away. Percy Shelley was this poet who believed in free love, so he ran off to France, and then they went on to other places in Europe. They got married eventually. Mary had a baby before they got married, and the baby died. I believe that the baby died so soon after childbirth that it wasn't even named, but it was a girl. So she had, this is before she writes Frankenstein, she had experience of the death of a child in the family. And then they had two more children who died as infants, just, I think, very in the period around the time that Frankenstein was being published, so after it had been written. And she had one son by Shelley who survived, who was also called Percy. He was born in 1890 and he survived and lived to ripe old age. But Shelley himself, who we will be studying, Shelley himself drowned in 1822. So it's all terribly tragic, dramatic, very sad. Mary returned to England with her surviving son Percy, and she herself lived to the age of 53 when she died of a brain tumour, if you can imagine that. She also published further novels, none of them as famous as Frankenstein, and very interestingly, she actually rewrote parts of the original novel. I had not known this until I reread for this class. I reread it, and I thought, well, hang on a minute, I remember it differently. And then I discovered that there was a little section that had been completely rewritten, a description of a character and where she came from. And as we're going through the story, I'll mention it. So you'll know which version you're looking at, the 1831 version or the 1818 version. Okay, let's have a look. Fabulous novel. It's called Frankenstein, and then it has a subtitle. Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus. Mary and her husband, so this is Percy Shelley, spent the summer of 1816. You'll remember, as I've mentioned it before, this was the year without a summer. The volcanic eruption had altered the weather, and it was raining, cold in the summertime. Crops didn't grow. So they spent the summer with Lord Byron, the poet, John Polidori, who also later published a book, a Gothic novel called The Vampire, and Claire Claremont, who was Mary's half-sister. They went to Geneva. They had a house in Geneva that Lord Byron had taken, and the group entertained each other with ghost stories. And in the introduction to the 1831 edition, this is what Mary said. So in 1831, looking back, she remembered. She said, "I passed the summer of 1816 in the environs of Geneva. The season was cold and rainy, and in the evenings we crowded round a blazing wood fire and occasionally amused ourselves with some German stories of ghosts, which happened to fall into our hands." But later on, she had a dream. She saw a vision of what she was going to put in the book, and she spent, she spent 2 years writing it properly. She thought it was going to be a short story, and I think her husband encouraged her to turn it into a proper novel. So she started writing the story when she was 18, and the first edition of the novel was published anonymously in London on the 1st of January 1818. When she was 20, and her name first appeared on the second edition, which was published in France in 1823. So when it first came out, nobody knew that it had been written by a woman, importantly. Prometheus, from the title. Now, Prometheus is the character from Greek mythology who steals fire from the gods and is punished for it by the gods. Prometheus, I'm simply taking this from Wikipedia, let me read you through it. Prometheus became a figure who who represented human striving effort, particularly the quest for scientific knowledge and the risk of overreaching or unintended consequences. And in particular, he was regarded in the Romantic era as embodying the lone genius whose efforts to improve human existence could also result in tragedy. Okay, so this is the idea. And interestingly, Shelley himself, the poet Percy Shelley, wrote a four-act lyrical drama called Prometheus Unbound in 1820. So he was also interested in the concept of Promethean fire and the Promethean genius. In our website, in the section on the Gothic novel, there is a link to questions about Frankenstein, things to think about Frankenstein, and they mention this, so it's worth thinking about, or possibly even commenting in the forums. Okay, let's start. It begins with the first narrator. The first narrator is called Robert Walton. Are you with us, right? Are you with us? Yes? Yes? Okay, right. You have to pay attention because this is a novel which has multiple narrators. It's got the framework of the story itself is a story within a story within a story. So three narrators. Okay, and no overarching narrator to tell you that, to make any judgments about the different narrations. The outer shell, the outer framework, so beginning, right at the beginning, and then right at the end of the novel, this frame is given by Robert Walton, who is a character that you don't see in the middle. Okay, so you've got the frame, he disappears, and then you've got the story, and then he comes back at the end. Okay, so Robert Walton, he's an Arctic explorer. Sorry, I spelt Arctic wrong, haven't I? He's writing to his sister Margaret back in England. What does that make it? I've left it just space so people can have a guess. What kind of novel is it when it's based on letters that are written to people? Sorry, I really let me just open you up. Can you remember the name of... Ah, thank you very much, you're in the epistolary. Lovely, very good, absolutely right. So, technically, it is an epistolary novel, and there were epistolary novels going around at the time, as we know. Richardson, for example. So Shelley thought, okay, that's a good thing to work with. And she uses it as the framework, which gives it depth, gives it a very interesting depth. These are not just characters who appear momentarily. He's depicted, in fact, as anxious, lonely. He says, but I have one want, which I have never yet been able to satisfy, is travelling in the Arctic in a boat with sailors, and the absence of which I now feel as the most severe evil. I have no friend, Margaret. When I am glowing with the enthusiasm of success, there will be none to participate in my job. If I am assailed by disappointment, no one will endeavour to sustain me in dejection. There's nobody here to share my joys or to share my sorrows. So the character of Robert Walton is not just a character who's thrown in for giving a framework. He's fully realised. He's a rounded character. You feel sorry for him. You understand how he's suffering. But he helps us to see into the story in a different way. What happens? Well, Walton catches a glimpse of the monster on the ice, travelling by sledge. They are stuck in the ice. They're trying to find the Northwest Passage, which is the way around to the Pacific Ocean from the Atlantic. And there were people at this time, just after Frankenstein had been published, Franklin set out on an expedition to do exactly that. So people in Britain were talking about this idea of finding the Northwest Passage. So this is a very contemporary reference to scientific interests and scientific endeavours. So Walton is our sort of scientist, even outside the story of Frankenstein itself. And the lovely, the wonderful moment where he sees the monster on the ice, he has no idea that it's the monster. He sees it in the distance, it's something travelling on a sledge, it's a very big figure, He doesn't know what it is. He doesn't see it directly. But that means it's there. She's planted the seed in the story from the beginning. What happens next? Walter meets Victor Frankenstein, who's following the monster. And Victor Frankenstein's, you know, he's half dead from cold. He's been traveling. He's in bad health. Walter rescues Frankenstein and they become friends. So Walter says, I begin to love him as a brother. Remember, this is in the letter to Margaret. I begin to love him as a brother. His constant and deep grief fills me with sympathy and compassion. He must have been a noble creature in his better days, being even now in wreck, so attractive and amiable. Okay, and remember, at the end of the book, the climax of the story will come back to Walton's ship. Okay, so, on board Walton's ship, Frankenstein tells the story. So now we have the second narrator. This is Frankenstein speaking. Now you must remember, even if you don't manage to read the book, that Frankenstein is the person who creates the monster. The monster has no name. The monster is not Frankenstein. The monster is a monster, a demon, a creature. It has no name. Very interesting. Okay, so Victor Frankenstein is telling the story. He was born into a family from Geneva with two brothers and an adopted sister or cousin. This is where the versions differ. In one version, I remember, you know, that they adopt Elizabeth as a little girl who's nothing to do with the family at the age of five. And in the version that I reread recently, it seems that she was a cousin that was adopted into the family. So, well, either way, she is part of the family. She's sort of a sister, but she's not a sister. She knows Victor from when he was a child. She loves him. But she's not, it's not impossible for them to get married later on. That's the important thing. Okay, so there's the two brothers, Elizabeth, and an adopted orphan who's called Justine, who becomes nanny to the younger brother. Victor's mother dies. After the death of his mother, Victor Frankenstein goes to study in Ingolstadt. Remember, all of this happens in Geneva, he's from Geneva, he's Swiss. He's not British, he's Swiss. He goes to study in Ingolstadt, where he begins to imagine building a human, and he talks about science. He says, in other studies, you go as far as others have gone before you, and there's nothing more to know, but in a scientific pursuit, there's continual food for discovery and wonder. You know, a really positive message about the value of science. And he thinks, he asks himself, whence, from where? Did the principle of life proceed? And soon he says, after days and nights of incredible labor and fatigue, I succeeded in discovering the cause of generation and life. Nay, more, I became myself capable of bestowing animation upon lifeless matter. Now, can you suggest what he could be using to put life, animation, into lifeless matter? Any ideas about what he could have been thinking about, or what she could have been suggesting, the writer? Corpses. Using corpses, absolutely. Child houses, yeah. And then what? Electricity, absolutely. Electricity. Galvanism. Hang on a minute, I've got some dates for galvanism. Galvani, 1786, discovered that he could make animal's legs twitch. So this was really, really up to date. It was right modern science that we're getting here. You know, even though it produces something terrible, and we know that galvanism can't make things live, it means that, you know, they were thinking, she was thinking about contemporary scientific questions, and they would have talked about it in the family. So, what happens? The monster is brought to life. At 1 in the morning, the rain pattered dismally against the panes. And Frankenstein, in the text, his eye, saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard. The convulsive motion agitated his limbs. Wonderful stuff. Can you remember what is the name of the literary figure where the weather imitates the feelings of people, or gives some kind of atmospheric effect? Irene, you're good at this. Go on, tell us what the name of The literary figure is when you've got the weather mirroring the drama or the feeling of tension in the narrative. See if you can remember. Well, it begins with P. Pathetic fallacy. A fallacy suggesting that it's not real. No, okay. Irina, you're asking, does Robert Walton see the creature on the ice before meeting Victor? Yes, he does. Absolutely. He sees the creature in the distance on the ice first. Then he finds Victor because Victor is following the monster. We find out why at the end. Okay, so there's a fallacy here. Although, to be honest, Mary Shelley is very, very measured with how much pathetic fallacy she uses. She has beautiful descriptions of the mountains, the landscape. There's some wonderful nature descriptions, and she's very careful not to overuse synthetic fallacy, because if you overuse things, they become cliches, as we've seen in Gothic novels. And, you know, it's a bit funny, really, isn't it? So she's very, very careful about how she uses this. But here, I think we can definitely say that's synthetic fallacy. Okay, what happens? He finds the monster repulsive. Now the time had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart. What happens? He runs away. He leaves the creature in his apartment and he goes. No, he doesn't even speak to the creature. He does nothing. He goes, and he runs from the apartment, leaving it. At this point, it's interesting, though, thinking about Gothic novels, that Shelley teases the reader. She plays a little bit with us. Victor goes back to the room later on. Okay. So he's gone away, and you think, oh, what should I do? What should I do? And then he goes back. I threw the door forcibly open, as children are accustomed to do when they expect a spectre, a ghost, to stand and waiting for them on the other side. But nothing occurred. those are the cliches of the Gothic horror, isn't it? But she's interesting because she's suggesting that this facile type of fright is for children. But this novel is not for children, and you know this is very much a novel for adult readers to understand what's happening. Creature had gone. At this, Victor has a nervous breakdown, and then he's nursed back to health in Ingolstadt by his friend Henry Clerval. Remember Clerval's name; he's going to appear again in the story. During this time, Elizabeth writes to him with news from home. Remember, home for them is in Geneva and Victor is in Ingolstadt. Justine has rejoined the family after taking care of her mother. This is interesting. Elizabeth comments on the lack of class distinctions in Switzerland. The republican institutions of our country have produced simpler and happier manners than those which prevail in the great monarchies that surround it. Hence, there is less distinction between the several classes of its inhabitants, and the lower orders, being neither so poor nor despised, their manners are more refined and moral. So basically, she's saying that, you know, the society in Switzerland, as is organized without a monarchy, is better. And Justine is part of a family, although technically she's like a servant. She's not. They don't treat her like that. She's part of a family. This is important as well. There are no characters are wasted in this story. Absolutely everybody is an important part of the story. Okay, well, this screen is the monster strikes. Victor starts to recover from his breakdown. And we see here examples of the lovely descriptions that Shelley can make. Remember, she is married to one of the great romantic poets. When we come to study Shelley, when you look at the anthology, the Shelley section, Percy Shelley, is enormous. He's very prolific for the very short life that he lived, and wonderful. And they were surrounded by other poets, and we're going to see examples of that as well. But here is Mary Shelley, a serene sky and verdant fields filled me with ecstasy. The present season was indeed divine. The flowers of spring bloomed in the hedges, while those of summer were already in bud. So, you know, flowers, nature, it's all very pretty. And he's getting better. But nobody gets better in a Gothic novel. A letter from his father brings terrible news. His youngest brother, William, has been horribly murdered, strangled when out walking. And Justine has been suspected. So Victor returns to Geneva, and a storm breaks out as he arrives. And he sees the creature. Here we're not, it's really, really not pathetic fallacy. It's drama. It's like Wagner or something. he sees the monster. As he arrives in Geneva and the mountains, the Alps, mountain scenery, he sees the monster in a flash of lightning. And perceived in the gloom, a figure, gloom is darkness, a figure which stole from behind a clump of trees near me. I stood fixed, gazing intently. I could not be mistaken. A flash of lightning illuminated the object and discovered, showed its shape plainly to me, its gigantic stature and the deformity of its aspect, more hideous than belongs to humanity, instantly informed me that it was the wretch, the filthy demon, to whom I had given life. What did he there? Could he be, I shuddered at the conception, the murderer of my brother? The monster, Victor realizes, has become my own vampire, my own spirit let loose from the grave and forced to destroy all that was dear to me. And this is a prophecy which will, of course, come true. He goes on destroying the people that Victor loves. Okay, the Alps. Has anybody been to the Alps? Have you? Go on, tell us about it. Really pointy mountains.
Yes, I went to the Alps.
Yep.
Near the lakes.
Yep.
And
yep.
The city train.
Yep.
There's a
exactly. But it's spectacular, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, incredible mountains. Wonderful descriptions of it. Right, okay, well, Shelley herself, you know, they travelled through Europe. They went to Geneva. We know they were in Geneva when they were visiting Byron. She would have seen this scenery. So, you know, the descriptions are wonderful. If you don't, you know, just read it for the descriptions of the Alps, it's spectacular. Victor can't tell his family that he suspects the monster of killing William, because he thinks that he won't be believed. He thinks there's no way that they could believe that somebody else did it. And Justine seems to have been framed by a monster. Justine's condemned to death, and Victor cannot save her. And in a very horribly dry way, the book just goes, and on the morrow, Justine died. But by this time, you have invested feelings in the characters. Shelley is very, very clever with, you know, building up. It's not a short story. She takes time to develop the characters and to make us feel involved in the family so that you're shocked when Justine finally dies. William, we haven't met, but we knew, you know, he's part of Victor's family. Also, we feel the shock. It's a child, and he's ill. Victor thinks of killing himself. He wants to commit suicide, but he thinks of Elizabeth and his father, and he doesn't. He goes on a journey instead into the mountains. And again, here we see the romantic vision. People who were travelling through Europe on the grand tour, which is the typical thing that aristocrats did on fishing, so you go off to Europe, they would see these things. Ruined castles hanging in the precipices of piney mountains. The impetuous Arve, that's a river, and cottages every here and there, creeping forth from among the trees, form the scene of singular beauty. But it was rendered sublime, so more important, more grand. This word sublime we've seen it before, it's important for the romantics. Sublime by the mighty Alps, whose white and shining pyramids and domes towered above all, as belonging to another earth, the habitations of another race of beings. These sublime and magnificent scenes afforded me the greatest consolation that I was capable of receiving. They elevated me from all bitterness of feeling, and although they did not remove my grief, they subdued and tranquilized it. I can't help reading into this the grief that she must have felt, the child that she lost. And it's difficult to read that without knowing that she was somebody who had a child who died a couple of days after it was born. It's difficult not to read into this feelings that Mary Shelley herself have felt. Okay, so when he's in the mountains, he meets the monster, because the monster is looking for him. So the monster, and the monster loves cold places. It's very much a novel about ice and very, very tremendous cold, and how the monster can survive in these places quite easily. And the monster comes up to him in the mountains, and he challenges Victor. So here we find the third narrator. This is the point at which we get the monster's side of it. So we get everybody's side of the story. The monster challenges Victor. He says, "Do your duty towards me, and I will do mine towards you and the rest of mankind. If you will comply with my conditions, I will leave them and you at peace. But if you refuse, I will glut the maw of death until it be satiated with the blood of your remaining friends." To glut the maw. Have a guess what that could be. What does that mean? Glut the maw of death. Yes, exactly. Yes, glut would be to fill. If you are glutted, you are full up. And maw is mouth. So the mouth of death is going to be full with the blood of your friends. Terrific. Terrifying. The monster has had an idea. The monster wants Victor to make him a mate, a female version of himself, to give him something to love and to be loved by. This concept of love and hate, which is at the center of the story, I've changed a couple of it. It's interesting because I had a problem with, do I describe the monster with it? But in fact, in the novel, the monster is he. So I've changed it, but obviously I haven't changed everything. So it's, we hear the story of what he's done since he was created. And the description is how the monster felt at first. Saw, felt, heard, and smelt at the same time. The light became more and more oppressive to me, and the heat wearing. And then he goes outside the apartment, he goes out into the countryside. I lay by the side of a brook, I ate some berries. The monster is a vegetarian. Percy Shelley, the poet, was a vegetarian, we know. I would be very surprised if Mary Shelley was eating a lot of meat, living married to Shelley. So, you know, there's a theme here of that it's better to eat plants and things, because the monster does. And also at this time, the interesting thing with the development or the description of what happens to the monster, how it develops, comes from a link to an essay that was published at this period, which was by John Locke, a very influential political thinker. And it was called An Essay Concerning Human Understanding. So here's Mary Shelley's concept of, you know, if you make a human, what happens to it? How does it begin to have senses? How does it develop in some way? So the monster discovers fire and then comes out of the forest and fighting local shepherds and villagers wherever he goes. And eventually, he finds shelter in a structure, a wooden structure, which has been built onto the side of a cottage. And there are pieces of wood where he can look into the inside of the house. So he's not in the house, but he can see the people inside the cottages. What is a cottage? No, it's bigger than that. No, a cottage is just a little casita in a rustic house. Yes, a little garajita. Quite small, nothing elaborate. But a cottage is a small rural house. But there's this structure that's been built onto the outside, so you can see inside without being at all connected or seen by the people inside the house. And he eavesdrops on the family. So the monster goes on and he tells about how he has educated himself. And just look at this. It's not just, you know, that the monster is monstrous. Mary Shelley is fascinated by education. And you think, you know, she'd been brought up in a family who were incredibly literate and knowledgeable and thinkers. But she was a girl. She wouldn't have been, she wouldn't have had access to the same kind of education that anybody else at the same time would have had romance. So Percy Shelley had been to Oxford, although he'd been thrown out for writing a document about atheism. So he'd spent 6 months in Oxford. So he was a sort of university graduate. Mary Shelley hadn't had that same kind of access to education. And it appears, you know, that she's fascinated with the way that you can educate yourself. So the monster spends his time watching the cottages that people inside. So an old man and his adult son and daughter, who have a very sad winter with very little food. But the monster has helped them without them knowing it, or knowing about him. He cuts firewood in the night. And he listens to them speaking to each other, and he gradually learns how to speak. And then apply the words fire, milk, bread, and wood. He sees the love that the family has for each other, and he starts to hope that they will understand and come to love him. He wants to have what they have. In particular, he wants love. In the spring, a young Turkish woman arrives. She's the woman that the son loves. And the monster is very, very interesting, very clever, because what she does is the Turkish woman has little French to be able to speak to the family, so they have to start teaching her, and the monster is listening, so the monster is learning. The monster is able to learn more language as the family teaches the new arrival how to speak their language. So he says, while I improved in speech, I also learned the science of letters, as it was taught to the stranger, so he learns how to write, and this opened before me a wide field for wonder and delight. Every conversation of the cottagers now opened new wonders to me. While I listened to the instructions which Felix, this is a young man, bestowed upon the Arabian, the strange system of human society was explained to me. But this is a sad moment, because with knowledge comes a change in the monster's feelings, because the monster begins to reflect that he's alone and that he's unlike humans. And now he begins to feel angry that he's excluded from human affections. Very interestingly, he also finds a bag which has been lost in the forest. And in the bag, he finds some books. We've got Goethe's Sorrows of Werther, Milton's Paradise Lost, and Plutarch's Lives, which educate him about human emotions. Do we know anything about Paradise Lost? You must have studied it last year. What do you know? What do you remember? What's it about? In what way? Who's it? Yeah. Adam and Eve, that's it. Garden of Eden. Evil and Satan. Satan is the character that you see in Paradise Lost, which is very interesting if you look at this, of course, because our Satan character is the monster, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, right, the monster reveals himself next. The monster plans to show himself to the cottagers. He thinks of them as my protectors, but they don't know he's there. He shows himself to the old man first. The old man is blind. So he knows that he can speak to the old man without him being frightened by how he looks. So he speaks to the old man first, pretending to be a traveller, but when the son and daughter arrive, they're horrified and they drive the monster away. Felix, the young man, darted forward and with supernatural force tore me from his father, to whose knees I clung like a child. In a transport of fury, he dashed into the ground and struck me violently with a stick. This is very interesting, because this is a lovely example of the energy of the verbs that Mary Shelley uses. If you look at the language that she uses in a lot of the action sections, other Gothic novels are, you know, ladies fainting, if we remember, you know, walking around castles. Very strange things happening, but not in a very energetic way. There is massive energy in the verbs that she chooses. I mean, look at this. Clung, tore, dashed, struck. They're all violent, extreme verbs. You know, linguistically, it's a fascinating piece. But of course, you know, teenagers, we've all been there. She's a teenager. She's 18 when she wrote this. Fabulous, fabulous energy. It's wonderful. Okay, the monster runs away. And remember, it's the monster telling the story at this point. So the monster says, I gave vent to my anguish in fearful howlings. Oh! This is, and so he feels bad, but he's driven away. He travels. He meets people who run away from him. He tries to help people, but he's shot at. And eventually, he comes to Geneva. Now, what do you know about Geneva? Geneva is where the family lives. Exactly. Right. Comes to Geneva, and he happens to meet William, Frankenstein's younger brother. And he finds out who he is. Frankenstein, you belong then to my enemy, to him towards whom I have sworn eternal revenge. You shall be my first victim. And he kills the one who strangles William. And then he explains a little bit about how Justine has been, you know, wrongly accused of the crime because the monster hides something that William was wearing. He meets Justine, though she's asleep, he puts it in her pocket. It's all very, you know, great coincidences. You won't meet coincidences like this until you read books by Thomas Hardy, but that's okay. You know, we're not too bad about this coincidence. It's only one, and it's not too bad. So, this is the end of the monster's narrative, and then we return to the scene in the Alps, where Victor's talking to the monster. Okay, so we're back to the sort of present, inside the second story, right? Now, here is where the monster asks for a mate. The monster now persuades Victor to make a female for him to have company. Victor says, so remember, now the I is Victor, okay? His words had a strange effect on me. I compassionated him and sometimes felt a wish to console him, so he feels sorry. But when I looked upon him, when I saw the filthy mess that moved and tore, my heart sickened. And my feelings were altered to those of terror and hatred. So he can't help himself. He can't love the monster. He tries to feel pity, but it's looking at him that seems to provoke disgust. The monster argues with him. There's lots of arguing. You felt that Mary Shelley must have been brought up in a house where they were constantly just talking and arguing, and it was okay, and everybody argued about things, thought things through, talked all the time. So the monster gives his side of the argument. I shall feel the affections of a sensitive being and become linked to the chain of existence and events from which I am now excluded. He wants to be part of, you know, humanism. So, Victor agrees to make a female. And he plans to go to England, where there are scientists that he can learn from. But he's also depressed. I think I would be. He says, my melancholy, which every now and then would return by fits and with a devouring blackness overcast the approaching sunshine. That's the melancholy. I passed whole days on the lake alone in a little boat, watching the clouds and listening to the rippling of the waves, silent and listless. Again, this is just a wonderful description of feeling depressed. But before he goes to England, he agrees to marry Elizabeth. But he's, you know, he's concerned that he wants to get the promise to the monster out of the way. He needs to get this work done without anybody finding out about it. So Victor goes to England. It's a travel novel. We've been to Switzerland, and now we're coming to England. And in fact, it's very interesting because tourism at that point was becoming actually quite popular. People did travel around, visit big houses, and go on little tours. So there's a little aspect of that. You know, they go to Oxford and they say how lovely it was. Frankenstein travels to England with Clerval. Remember Henry Clerval, his friend who nursed him back to health at the beginning. They see beautiful places, but Victor can't enjoy them He says, I was occupied by gloomy thoughts, and so neither saw the descent of evening star, nor the golden sunrise reflected in the Rhine. This is a lovely piece of what I would call, technically it's called parallepsis, and we've met it before. It's when you say, I'm not going to talk about that, this thing that is so terrible, and it's like this, and like this, and like this. You say you're not going to do something, and then you talk about it, and by talking about it, you have talked about it. So, you know, you can't read that line without seeing the evening star and the golden sunrise reflected in the Rhine. So even if Victor can't enjoy them, the reader can. It's lovely. Okay, but very interestingly here, Clerval is very happy. He says that Clerval, the friend, is a being formed in the very poetry of nature. And these words come in the text inside quotation marks, and readers at the time may have known. We are lucky we have the internet, we look it up, and we discover it is a quotation from Leigh Hunt, who was a contemporary of the Shelleys, was a friend of the Shelleys, in fact actually named two of his children after Percy Shelley, after his death. And so she quotes from this friend, the poetry of nature. And this is the essence of the Romantic movement, this poetry of nature. The scenery of external nature he loved with ardour. And then she quotes from Wordsworth, who was the previous generation. We haven't studied them yet. We've leapt forward in time. We're going to do the Romantic poets now. And they're coming up. The older Romantic poets, like Wordsworth and Coleridge, and younger Romantic poets, Shelley and Byron and Keats. But this is a little piece from Wordsworth's Tintern Abbey. A sounding cataract haunted him like a passion. It's lovely. And there's more of it in the text. It's a piece about six lines long. But Victor, in contrast, is a blasted tree. The bolt has entered my soul. So lightning and light and electricity and disaster. They separate. So they go, so this is Henry and Victor travel up to Scotland. They reach Perth, and then Victor insists on, you know, Henry, you must go over there, and I'm going to go this way. So I'll see you later, in another few months or something. And he goes alone to one of the remotest of the Orkney Islands. Now, the Orkney Islands are on the side of, not at the top of Scotland, but on the side of Scotland, quite near Ireland. And there he's going to make the female creature. Now, he begins to have doubts. He thinks she might also turn with disgust she might also turn with disgust to the superior beauty of man. She might quit him and he'd be alone again. So she's thinking, Victor is thinking that a female monster might find humans more beautiful and leave the monster for him. A race of devils is another possibility. They could have children. A race of devils could be propagated upon the earth, which might make the very existence of the species of man a condition precarious and full of terror. Some people call Frankenstein one of the very earliest science fiction novels. So science fiction, looking into the future, what could happen if we do this? It's a very interesting type of examination which we still have to do nowadays. You know, what do we do if we do genetic mutations? You know, this kind of debate is very relevant to us in modern day. When he finishes making the female, and then he sees the monster watching him through the window, and in terrible fury, he tears apart the female. This is Victor himself. Tears apart the female monster he has just made. And the monster disappears with a howl of devilish despair and revenge. And then he comes back, he returns, and he threatens Victor. He says, you are my creator, but I am your master. Beware. Your hours will pass in dread and misery, and soon the bolt will fall, which must ravish you from your happiness forever. Are you to be happy while I grovel in the intensity of my wretchedness? You can blast my other passions, but revenge remains. Revenge, henceforth, dearer than light or food. So revenge for him is going to be more important than food or than sunlight. I may die, but first you, my tyrant and tormentor, shall curse the sun that gazes on your misery. Beware, for I am fearless and therefore powerful. This is one of the lines that's quoted sometimes from Frankenstein. Beware, for I am fearless and therefore powerful. And also is, you can't quite see it because of the computer thing, but it says, I shall be with you on your wedding night. This is the threat that he gives. I will be with you on your wedding night. And Victor interprets this as a threat to himself. The monster strikes again. Victor leaves the island in a small boat, but he's blown offshore towards the Irish coast. And when he lands, immediately he's accused of murder because Clerval's body has been found on the shore, strangled, and left deliberately by the monster in the place where Victor lands. So Victor's imprisoned. He has a breakdown, and eventually he's freed and is taken home by his father. And at home in Geneva, Victor prepares to marry Elizabeth. But he's continually thinking about the threat of the monster. But as if possessed of magic powers, the monster had blinded me to his real intentions. And when I thought that I had prepared only my own death, I hastened that of a far dearer victim. These are premonitions of, well, what we suppose is going to happen. Elizabeth will die, this is it, yes. Okay, so they start their honeymoon in the Alps, and it's nighttime when they reach the inn. The moon had reached her summit in the heavens and was beginning to descend. The clouds swept across it swifter than the rays of the vulture and dimmed her rays, while the lake reflected the scene of the busy heavens, rendered still busier by the restless waves that were beginning to rise. Suddenly, a heavy storm of rain descended. What could we say this is? Literary trope? Literary figure? Probably. What do you think? Prophetic fallacy. Yeah, not fallacy by itself, but prophetic fallacy. That's it. Yes. Something dreadful is going to happen. It's and the landscape is telling us. Yeah. Victor tells Elizabeth to go to bed. He wants to check the inn. He's got his pistols and he's got a dagger as well. He thinks that the danger is outside. Movie directors have taken this idea, you know, in their hundreds afterwards. He hears a scream and he arrives in the room to find that the monster has killed Elizabeth. And he tries to shoot him, but the monster runs away. And after that, he just has a total breakdown. His father dies of grief. And at that point, Victor decides to follow the monster and to kill it. So he tracks it to the Arctic, where he meets Walton, and he comes back in a full circle back to Walton. So we finish with Walton closing the story. The narrative returns to Walton, writing a series of letters to his sister. You have read this strange and terrific story, Margaret. And when he says terrific, he doesn't mean, yeah, great. He means terrific, which is sort of an archaic word here. And you have read this story, and do you not feel your blood congeal with horror like that which even now curdles mine? So he's saying, okay, it was a horrible, horrible story. Frankenstein's health gets worse. They're on this ship in the Arctic. They are frozen in at this point. And he asks Walton to undertake my finished work, destroy the monster. And Walton agrees to destroy the monster. And then, after various conversations, about half an hour afterwards, he, meaning Frankenstein, attempted again to speak, but was unable. He pressed my hand feebly, and his eyes closed forever, while the irradiation of a gentle smile passed from his lips. So Victor has died. Yeah, he's died, but of natural causes, exhaustion and cold, having chased the monster to the Arctic, and there's long descriptions of how terrible it is and the journeys he makes across Europe and then up to the Arctic. Walton breaks off his writing for a while, and then in the letter, he comes back, so one letter is finished, and then he comes back and says, you'll never guess what happened. I will describe it to you now. So there's a lot of, it's very dramatic, very immediate, the form of the letter. He describes how he came into the room where Victor's body was lying in the bed, and he found the monster hanging over him, crying in grief and horror. So the monster is grieving for Victor. Oh, Frankenstein, generous and self-devoted being, what does it avail that I now ask thee to pardon me? What use is it for me to ask thee to pardon me? It's no use. And then Walton actually talks to the monster, so they have a dialogue, and the monster explains his feelings of misery after killing Elizabeth. He says, evil thenceforth after the killing became my good, and now it is ended. There is my last victim. The monster says he's going to kill himself. He says, I shall no longer see the sun or stars or feel the winds play on my cheeks. My spirit will sleep in peace, or if it thinks, it will not surely think thus. Farewell. And after he says this, these are the last lines of the novel. Told by Walton in the letter, it goes, he sprang from the cabin window as he said this, upon the ice raft which lay close to the vessel. He was soon borne away by the waves and lost in the darkness and distance. Fabulous, fabulous ending. The monster is going to commit suicide, but we don't see it. We don't get closure, but we do get the monster disappearing into the ice and the waves. Okay. Right, well, that's it. That's what the novel is about. How do you feel about the novel after having seen quite a lot of details about it? Writing that at 18, yes. Mary Shelley describes how by writing this, she stopped being a child, she moved into her adult life, and this is tremendous, tremendous. But I think probably she'd run away with Shelley at the age of 16, and they'd eloped, and she'd had a baby. She was quite grown up for a teenager, but it's an amazing, amazing feat of writing by any standard. I mean, it's a marvellous, marvellous novel. And it deserves to be more widely read. It deserves to be read properly and appreciated for, the piece of literature that it is, as well as for having inspired lots of movies. Because, I haven't seen the Kenneth Branagh one, which is probably quite faithful to the text. But other things which have come from Frankenstein are, the monster with the bolt through his neck. And this is the image that we have of Frankenstein. Now, I think it's been taken from Shelley, and I think we could take it back. You get people to read it. It's fabulous. You can read it in translation. Why not? Okay. Right. Thank you very much for coming, Irene. That's super. Okay. We'll see you next week. Oh, Fanny Burney next week. At least we leave all the horror. We go to something funny. That's a nice way to stop the whole Christmas. Okay. See you next week.